From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called allegations that Russia interfered in the presidential election in favor of Donald Trump disturbing, but he ruled out a special committee to investigate. And he stood by the director of National Intelligence's assessment released before the election that the Russian government hacked institutions such as the Democratic National Committee.
That is what the intelligence community believes can be said in unclassified remarks without risking sources and methods. Anything else, is irresponsible, likely illegal, and potentially for partisan political gain.
Joining us now is Here and Now security analyst Dr. Jim Walsh with MIT's Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, and a lot to talk about here, but let's start with that assessment from the CIA that Russia interfered with the election with the primary aim of helping to elect Trump. I want to get to the reaction in a moment, but first, your thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, I think we need to be clear. There is no disagreement within the intelligence community across the 16 agencies that Russia did launch cyber attacks intended to disrupt the elections. No one disputes that in the intel community. Where their disagreement is, what was the nature of the intention? You could disagree about, were they trying to get Trump elected, or was it simply to cause chaos or to undermine Hillary Clinton? You know, reasonable people can disagree over intentions. And we should also distinguish that from making the claim that says the hacking tipped the election results. There are lots of things that could have tipped an election that was so close. Maybe that's one of them. Maybe it could be other things. But again, the key line here, no one in the intel community disputes that Russia conducted cyber attacks against a U.S. presidential election.
But Trump himself does. He tweeted today, unless you catch hackers in the act, it's very hard to determine who was doing the hacking. Why wasn't this brought up before the election? Of course, this idea was brought up before the election. But why is Trump dismissing these claims along with his top surrogates?
Very hard for me to read the mind of the president-elect. I must say I'm somewhat puzzled by his position because he actually called on Russia to conduct hacking of a Secretary Clinton during a presidential debate. So now he says he's surprised that the Russians did what he asked them to do.
We're learning, in addition to learning about what's happened with the Russian hack, that Trump is not taking his intelligence briefings as regularly as he otherwise would be, as other presidents have. Are you surprised by that?
I'm a little surprised by it. President Nixon didn't take a lot of intel briefings, but of course he had been vice president. He had some foreign policy experience. For someone who has no foreign policy experience, it's a little surprising. I'd say more surprising, more shocking to me, Jeremy, is the direct attacks on the intelligence community. For a president-elect to publicly rebuke and even mock the intelligence community seems to me like a self-inflicted wound, potentially dangerous. At some point, Mr. Trump, as president, may have to come to the American people and say, I have information, we are threatened, I need to act. And this is based on information from the intelligence community. He's completely undercutting any sort of future position he might be in if we face a crisis.
Jim, lots going on, and I want to ask you about another headline today. This morning, a Chinese party-controlled newspaper called Trump, quote, as ignorant as a child for saying yesterday that he wouldn't be bound by the one China policy that the U.S. and China have observed for decades. Of course, this is about Trump's call with the leader of Taiwan. Where do you see this leading?
Well, I would say we're really on sensitive ground here. I know it's an issue people haven't talked about for decades because it's been settled U.S. policy since Richard Nixon for more than 30 years. But it's important by context to know that Taiwan is, quote, a vital interest to China. That's foreign policy talk for we'll fight to the death over this. This is why it has been policy to sort of keep this in the icebox and not talk about it. So for Mr. Trump to sort of say we're going to revisit this even though he has no national security team in place, has no cabinet in place, is not receiving intel briefings, I think that could be a dangerous thing. If he pursues this, we will be alone. Our allies are not joining us on this. We will be the only people who are reversing that policy.
Well, and some people look at this and say, well, that's a bold move. Good for him for standing up to China.
Well, I totally believe in leverage and in trying to improve your bargaining position. But let's remember that China is a nuclear weapon state. Normally, it's a bad idea to threaten the vital interest of a nuclear weapon state who is an adversary. If people threatened Hawaii, we would not react well to it, even though Hawaii is farther away than Taiwan. Again, we should be pressing China as well as trying to cooperate with them on issues like North Korea. But this is one in my business, in the nuclear business, this is the only scenario in which you get China using nuclear weapons. That's a fight over Taiwan.
That's Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh, an expert in security at MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the recent election saw four states, California, Massachusetts, Maine, and Nevada, join Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Alaska in legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. Four other states, Arkansas, Florida, North Dakota, and Montana, voted for medical use. But the growing cannabis industry has relied on an Obama administration policy of tolerating state laws to regulate a substance that is still illegal under federal law. So what will a new Trump administration mean? From Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Oregon, Liam Moriarty reports.
It's been 2 years since voters in Oregon approved a measure that lets adults grow, buy, possess, and consume marijuana for recreational use. And while buying weed in Oregon isn't quite as simple as walking into your corner store and picking up a six-pack, it's pretty easy. I recently visited Breeze Botanicals in Gold Hill, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you doing today?
Pretty well. I'd like to buy some cannabis.
Oh, good.
The owner, Bree Malarkey, checks me in, inspects my ID to verify I'm at least 21, then leads me into the locked showroom.
Welcome to the other side of the wall.
Where she displays an impressive array of medicinal herbs, including marijuana, in glass jars. After quizzing Malarkey about the effects of various strains, I make my choice. Watermelon Kush.
I'll take a gram of that.
Yep, absolutely.
Excellent. Wrap it up.
I pay, put my purchase in the legally required childproof container, and I'm out the door. This now legal transaction happens tens of thousands of times a day in Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Alaska. What's allowed this to happen, since marijuana remains illegal under federal law, is a 2013 policy memo by then-Deputy Attorney General James Cole. The so-called Cole memo says that if states make effective efforts to keep pot away from kids, prevent driving while high, and address other concerns, the feds will look the other way. Will a Trump administration continue that policy? Here's candidate Trump at a rally in Nevada a year ago.
I think medical should happen, right? Don't we agree? I mean, I think so. And then I really believe you should leave it up to the states. It should be a state situation.
But Trump has expressed less supportive opinions on other occasions. And John Hudak says it's hard to say where he'll come down on this issue.
There is reason for us to believe that either outcome, either a pro-states rights outcome or a pro-prohibition outcome, could happen.
Hudak is a senior fellow at the D.C.-based Brookings Institution who's made a study of cannabis policy. He points out that the legal foundation on which the marijuana industry rests is pretty precarious.
The Cole memos can be rescinded by the stroke of the pen of the Attorney General.
And Trump's nominee for Attorney General, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, has very firm ideas of his own about marijuana. Here's Sessions at a Senate hearing last April.
This drug is dangerous. You cannot play with it. It's not funny. It's not something to laugh about. And trying to send that message with clarity that good people don't smoke marijuana.
But Troy Dayton isn't too worried. Dayton is CEO of the Arcview Group, a San Francisco-based investment and market research firm that focuses on cannabis. He acknowledges that if Sessions is appointed AG and if Trump gives him scope to set his own policy,
that would be devastating to the cannabis industry.
But Dayton remains bullish on the industry's future. He points to the growing success of legalization measures and to polls showing more than 60% of Americans support legal pot.
There is more political cost to going against the grain here than going with the grain.
And Dayton says he thinks Trump is unlikely to spend his political capital trying to put the marijuana genie back in the bottle. Attorney Henry Wieckowski agrees.
The more people that know how to grow it and appreciate the benefits of using it, the harder and harder it's going to be to stop.
Wieckowski is a prominent San Francisco lawyer who's represented many cannabis businesses during years of legal battles with the feds. He notes that since 2014, Congress has passed a budget rider that bars the Justice Department from using federal funds to interfere with state medical marijuana laws. And in 2015, a federal court slapped down a Justice Department attempt to circumvent the measure. Witkowski thinks it's likely Congress will extend that protection to states with recreational use laws as well.
Why would anybody want to deprive the states of the ability to regulate and tax cannabis and open up that market back to the illegal cartels?
At Breeze Botanicals, the herb shop in Oregon, owner Bree Malarkey recognizes the uncertainty that hangs over her business. But she says she creates jobs, she pays taxes, and works hard to do right by her employees and her clients. And she remains optimistic.
I keep saying to myself, if you know what you're doing is right and you're leading by example and you're trying to be a good citizen, you just keep fighting for what you know is right.
About 3 in 5 Americans now live in a state with some form of legal cannabis. Analysts say the industry is worth nearly $7 billion this year, and as the new states, including California, come online, that value is projected to approach $22 billion by 2020. For Here and Now, I'm Liam Moriarty in Ashland, Oregon.
The holidays approach. We're all running around getting Christmas and Hanukkah gifts for the people we love. But thousands of Americans across the country are scrambling to get gifts for people they don't even know. Today, we honor all of them with our look at a group here in Boston called Christmas in the City. It started 28 years ago as a party for about 100 homeless kids. Now, every Sunday before Christmas, almost 5,000 homeless kids and their families received gifts and a day-long extravaganza. Oh, and the next day, Christmas in the City provides gifts for another 13,000 kids who have homes but not much else. And not one of the 3,000 volunteers is paid a penny, including founders Jake and Sparky Kennedy. How? Well, for one thing, they work on it all year. We first brought you this story last year, starting at a summer planning session.
All right, so now we're on the actual parties. We'll buzz through this and we'll get out of here. So Saturday set up. The great thing is we will have Christmas trees to be painted and we will have murals.
That's Jake Kennedy, no relation to the other Boston Kennedys, at his clinic, Kennedy Brothers Physical Therapy. About 40 longtime volunteers of every age sprawl across massage tables to get an update on this year's event.
The day they can work any hours they want. They won't get paid a dime.
Here's Sparky Kennedy.
So it started in 1989. Jake and his clinic had a Poland Springs bottle. People started putting change in.
But wait, why did you decide to do this, Jake?
Well, our oldest, she was maybe, what, 4 years old?
Two.
Well, anyway, she got too many presents. So I said to Sparky, this is embarrassing. Let's keep it to 3. And we did. But then the relatives descend upon the house, and all weekend long she gets overwhelmed with presents. So she had no idea, like, you know, what Christmas meant, and that's how it started. We wanted to show her, you know, the other side of life.
Yeah, but as this is happening, 165 to maybe 400, 500, how are you, I mean, are you looking at each other at that point, Jake, and saying, oh, my God, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to pay for this?
Never.
Like, the demand from the homeless population just grows and grows and grows, and it's hard to say no to a kid at Christmas time. But then the volunteers come up, so we don't worry about the buses because someone's doing it. We don't worry about registering the early people because someone does it.
This is what we saw in your meeting. You start to have sort of captains, right, who are taking over things.
Yes. Mark, Lisa, volunteers, what should we know?
So signups are actually just opened, and they're going really, really well. But also, another cool thing is there's an organization. Does everyone know what cosplayers are? They dress up and go to, like, Comic-Con and everything. So there's a group called Cosplayers for a Cause, and they want to come and help greet everybody as they come in dressed in their, like, amazing uniforms. Costume. Okay, so everybody that's over 40, this isn't like Costco. This is like cost as in costume. I never heard of the term.
They're trying to outdo themselves every year, and then they call on their own volunteers. They call the student group, and they say, this is what I'm doing, so Spike and I don't worry about that.
What would you say now, Jake? What's the value of the food, the gifts, the entertainment?
Well, I mean, the convention center alone, they give it to us for an entire week. I mean, that's over $800,000 that they would charge us, which they do not. You know, we're into the $4 million or something, you know.
Did anyone ever say to you, stop it, you got to take salary here? Did you ever think it?
We've never thought it.
I was advised 1 hour ago by a very important man to take money out for administration, and I've told them a million times no, and we will always say no, because we just believe, we see the smiles on the kids, and we know they would not have this magic of the holidays if it wasn't for our volunteers.
Kennedy Brothers Physical Therapy, this is Sam speaking.
Okay, we fast-forwarded to about 2 weeks ago. The phones at Kennedy Brothers ring off the hook. Clients lift weights and sometimes jump up to receive gifts, which are piled high. A steady stream of moms come in to register their children for the day-after party for needy kids. But as Sparky and volunteer Dionne LeBlanc work at a computer, it's clear there might not be enough gifts.
Come in. These are all the Excel sheets.
Oh, so we still need a lot
and
more presents.
We still have to get rid of these, and these are big numbers. I mean, this is what we'll keep.
And as if on cue, a man walks in with an envelope.
Yes, that's awesome.
Wait, did you just hand Jake an envelope for $6,000?
Yes, I did.
And I'm sorry, what's your name?
My name is Kevin Leary. I have a law office across the street.
So how do you get those? Well, how did you get
that
money?
I just let us out every year, and the checks come in.
Well, and that's how it works, I guess.
That's how it works. More to come.
Thank you so much for coming. We can't tell you how much we appreciate you helping us throw the best party in Boston.
Finally, it's the Sunday before Christmas. The small and big donations have transformed the Boston Convention Center's main hall into a ballroom packed with linen-covered dinner tables.
Oh, my gosh. Now, there are hundreds of tables.
Just gonna be blown away.
I am blown away.
There's last-minute details.
I can't find where Tim's Catholic Charities is. Okay, Tim is, and his daughters are going to be team captains of Bridge Over Troubled Waters, so Hannah and Kate.
Okay.
They're going to be helping him.
Shelter captains who will shepherd the groups of children through the day get a pep talk from their general, Nancy McDonald.
All right, it's go time! You guys are the heart of Christmas in the City. You guys are the ones that really make it happen for these kids. The people that are coming to the party today that are living in shelters, they're living in hotels, they've had a really, really, really rough year, and we're here to give them the memory of their lives. Let's do it.
It's organized chaos.
That's Barry Chait, who's long done pro bono accounting work for Christmas in the City. He brought me into another cavernous room where the gifts are staged.
It looks like an airplane hangar.
What it is on the left, we have all the shelters alphabetized, and each shelter has all the gifts for the kids because each kid is getting a gift off of a wish list.
Okay, so there's these huge orange bins and wrapped packages as far as the eye can see.
Yep, and then the toy room is down there because if any child isn't happy, if they're crying because Billy got a basketball and they got a football and they want a basketball, they come back here and they exchange it for the basketball.
It's an airplane hangar. It's huge.
And beyond the wrapped gifts stood thousands of backpacks waiting like sentinels. This year, two families bought and packed them all, but for years it was just one, the Trambetta family.
Many parents have their kids going to play soccer. This family, they go to the supermarkets and stand out line and ask for donations for Christmas in the City. They raise enough money, and then they go online and they research backpacks. Each kid will get a backpack, which we'll have in it, books, hats, stuffed animals. Here they come, the first kids.
Here they come. There's a row of volunteers.
A gauntlet of volunteers, mostly college age, line both sides of a red carpet as the first of 150 busloads of families arrive.
Merry Christmas, y'all. Let's stay together. Stay together. We're going to ask you to follow these two lovely individuals. Merry Christmas!
There's a sit-down dinner, entertainment, choirs, big and small. Overseeing it all, Jake Kennedy.
Jake, do you ever get tired of this?
No. It's like, it invigorates me. I mean, I've already had tears in my eyes two or three times, so.
Just two or three?
No, already, but don't worry, there'll be more.
It's going to be a fun, fun day.
What does this mean to you as a mom?
It will help a lot, for me especially.
It's more than fun.
What is it?
I don't know.
It's joyful.
Yeah, joyful. It's a good time to spend with your family.
A worry-free time.
Yes. Yeah. I know what else is going to happen.
What?
The Winter Wonderland.
Oh, yes, it is. But before that, a contingent of bagpipes signals the arrival of Santa atop a fireman's cherry picker. And then a curtain slowly rises. Now, I won't say you had to see it to believe it because I don't believe it and I was there. What's revealed is a Hallmark card come to life. Snow falling gently on an indoor carnival, complete with tilt-a-whirl, carousels, snowball fights, pony rides. There are also flu shots, pedicures, Patriots quarterback Tom Brady's hairdresser. Now, Jake Kennedy is the son of the former dean of Northeastern University. I guess he didn't have personal experience with homelessness, but asked him anyway.
I had no idea. I mean, when we talked to first year, I talked to a kid, and I said, what happened last year? And he said, nothing. I said, Christmas morning, what happened? Nothing. You didn't get any presents? No. Did you have a celebration? Was your father? No. Were you upset? He said, no, it was just like any other day. I think that point we said, let's not just get him presents, but let him experience what we take for granted, which is like the incredible magic of this season.
Jake's wife, Sparky, says when other cities ask her how to do this kind of all-volunteer event, she says start small like they did. Jake says, no, go big. If you fail and you still help just one child, you succeed. He tells the story of the day a formerly homeless woman came into Kennedy Brothers.
And all of a sudden, this look came on her face, and I said, what's wrong? And she said, are you guys Christmas in the City? I go, yes, this is what we do. With tears in her eyes, she said, my son is in college now, and if you ask him what is most important day of his entire life, it was when he walked into Christmas in the City.
You get emotional when you tell that story.
I do. I get every year I get emotional. Just, I mean, you don't understand on a group of people that have to wait in line, that no promises are kept, they don't know what school they're going to, they don't know where they're going to live, they don't know where the next meal is coming from, what it means to be treated like princes and princesses. It's just, why do we do it? I wouldn't miss it.
Our visit last year with Christmas in the City. Yes, they're doing it again this Sunday. Yes, they could use donations. A reminder to think of them and the thousands of volunteers across the country who bring Christmas cheer to the less fortunate. You're listening to Here and Now. The polar vortex is back and it's going to get ugly. That was a headline Friday in USA Today, and sure enough, it is cold in much of the country. 1 degree above zero in Minneapolis, 9 degrees in Billings, Montana. This past weekend, parts of Chicago got up to 8 inches of snow, canceling more than 1,400 flights. They're also bracing for temperatures in the single digits this week. Dean DeVore is a meteorologist for AccuWeather. He joins us by Skype from State College, Pennsylvania. And Dean, this polar vortex, it's a phrase that became popular with we civilians a couple of years ago, but it sounds like a train or something. But it's air from the Arctic, right?
There's actually a couple of vortices up there. And a vortex is a spinning area of air, so there's a couple of levels of it, and pieces of that come down. Now, the polar vortex is always going on, whether it's winter or summer, but at certain times of the year, including the winter, it's pieces of it start breaking off and heading towards us. So, Robin, I think it's a combination of pieces of the polar vortex coming. We're also seeing a pattern shift overall from recent years. One of the pieces of that is we went from a El Nino and we're going into a mild La Nina here. And so there's differences this winter than the last couple where it stayed warmer longer, but now the colder air is already pushing down southward, and we're seeing evidence of that this late fall and early winter here already with some very cold temperatures and snowy events already.
Right. And you talk about these other wind patterns that cause weather. Well, so where's the coldest right now? What can people expect?
Well, we've got the cold air that had come through one big batch of it last week. Now it's kind of moderating a little bit, and the jet stream's a little farther north here over the next couple of days. Part of the reason we saw that storm that brought it 6 to 10 inches of snow in Detroit and the planes skidding off the runway yesterday, the snow in Chicago, and then the snow up into New England. Relaxation a little bit in the jet stream, and then another polar blast is going to come here as we go through the middle of the week, first from Saskatchewan all the way through the Central Plains, and then that cold air is going to just bury into the Northeast. And we're talking about areas in the Northeast like New York and Philly and Boston. They're going to have real feels, or how it feels with the wind and the cold, single digits, maybe even below zero for several hours during the daylight hours here as we get towards the end of this upcoming week.
Okay, there's that. But take a look at the Northwest, because we know the Pacific Northwest usually is hit by snow in the mountains, but it's been hitting coastal communities, Portland, for instance. Is that going to be a weather pattern this season?
Yeah, the colder air overall out west and the storming pattern out west. Now, we're not complaining. I mean, there's drought conditions that have been, you know, well documented up and down the western side of the country. So the storminess that we're getting in those areas is welcome. It's just certainly if you got to go through it, it's not so easy to go through. But we're going to talk about colder air and more storms in the Pacific Northwest, which should add to the rain and certainly the snowpack, which will be beneficial down the road. But yeah, I think a stormier time and certainly colder where we're going to see snow more so to the coast. Seattle doesn't always, you know, get snow very often if everything's usually up in the mountains, but we'll see, I think, a few more times than normal for that to occur here as we go through the winter.
Okay, so expect a big storm across the country later this week and a lot of snow in coastal communities in Oregon, two of the things to look for. Dean DeVore, meteorologist with AccuWeather there in Pennsylvania. Dean, thank you.
Have a great day.
And if you're not liking it, as he said, try to think of the drought. It's good for the drought.
President-elect Donald Trump has said he plans to cut taxes for individuals and corporations in order to stimulate the economy and create jobs. Republican leaders before him, notably Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, also cut taxes with the same reasoning. But did those tax cuts work? Joining us now is Donald Marin, who's the director of economic policy initiatives at the Urban Institute and former director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Donald Marin, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And let's listen to Donald Trump speaking in September at the Economic Club of New York, where he laid out his economic plan.
We're proposing a $4.4 trillion tax cut that will score as a $2.6 trillion under dynamic growth models, which is how taxes should be scored.
Now, taking out the econo speak in there, it sounds like a lot of tax cutting. What are you expecting Trump is going to do?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd note is that based on the estimates that my colleagues have done here at the Tax Policy Center, we think the tax cut he has in mind is significantly bigger, somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 to $7 trillion over the next 10 years. Hmm. To put that in some sort of context, that would be like reducing tax revenues by about 1/7. So one out of every $7 of tax revenue going away.
And largely for the higher incomes or for everybody?
And it's mostly tilted towards higher incomes. Absolutely.
What about for the middle class? Would they see tax cuts as well?
Pretty much everybody would see tax cuts. There are some folks at the lower end of the distribution because of income distribution, because of technical tax features that in his plan might actually see a tax increase. But, you know, it's impossible to believe that would survive the legislative process.
Would the idea of a $6 or $7 trillion tax cut over the course of 10 years be something that you think could make it through a Republican Congress?
You know, that's a lot of money. And we've seen several of the leaders in Congress say that they aspire to a revenue-neutral tax reform. This is one of the big debates you're going to see is between the folks who are focused on tax reform and the people who are focused on big tax cuts. Congress now accounts for what Mr. Trump mentioned, which is this dynamic scoring. So taking account of the fact that tax cuts or tax changes might affect the size of the economy and that might flow back and give you more or less revenue. So that'll make it slightly easier for them to enact tax reforms. But still, if they keep to their word and want to be anywhere close to revenue neutral, they're going to have to do something quite different from what Mr. Trump has proposed.
Well, let's talk about that idea that cutting taxes grows the economy and therefore, you know, some believe that they pay for themselves and give a lot of people more opportunity in this economy. Going back to Ronald Reagan, and let's listen to him. Here he is explaining his tax plan, which simplified the tax rates into three brackets of 15, 25, and 35%.
By lowering everyone's tax rates all the way up the income scale, each of us will have a greater incentive to climb higher, to excel, to help America grow.
Donald Marin, tell us what happened after Reagan's tax cuts. What happened to the economy?
Well, so the thing about the Reagan years is that there were actually three major tax bills. So he passed very large tax cuts early on in his administration, rolled back a significant fraction of them a year later, and then towards the end of his administration signed the major 1986 tax reform. So he has a complex tax legacy. I think in the quote that you ran, he's right to say that if you lower people's tax rates, that by itself can encourage them to work, save, and invest more and can contribute to the economy. What he left out, though, was that if you do that without finding a way to pay for it, so that at the same time you're also increasing deficits. Those deficits over time have a tendency to crowd out private investment and therefore to weaken the overall economy. And so if all you're doing is tax cutting, it's actually very hard to make that a long-run economic boost, even though obviously in the short run, putting more money in people's pockets can provide a short-run boost.
So just to be clear, his tax cuts, you're saying, did not pay for themselves. They added to the deficit.
Oh, yeah, there's no way they paid for themselves. And indeed, like I said, you know, one of the first things you saw is that they undid a chunk of them just a year later.
We also know that George W. Bush cut taxes. Here he is outlining his economic plan before a joint session of Congress in February 2001.
Tax relief is right, and tax relief is urgent. The long economic expansion that began almost 10 years ago is faltering. Lower interest rates will eventually help, but we cannot assume they will do the job all by themselves. 40 years ago, and then 20 years ago, two presidents, one Democrat, one Republican, John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan, advocated tax cuts to, in President Kennedy's words, get this country moving again. They knew then what we must do now. To create economic growth and opportunity, we must put money back into the hands of the people who buy goods and create jobs.
Now, Donald Maron, we know that at the end of Bush's presidency, there was a huge financial crisis and deep recession. But let's talk about the effects of his tax cuts. Did they do what he wanted them to do?
And so, again, a complicated legacy. President Bush signed significant tax bills. Obviously, the 2001 one did more in 2003, and then also passed some tax cuts in 2008 as part of the effort to combat the economics collapse. In 2001, you'll notice that his quote mostly focused on the effect of putting more money in people's pockets at a time of economic weakness. That's sort of the classic Keynesian demand-side argument that if the economy is turning down, you should cut taxes and possibly spend more government money as a way to help support the economy. I think the evidence that it provided some limited boost at the time, you know, and would expect that to happen even today if we did some sort of tax cuts. Beyond that, you know, very complicated period in economic history with all the other things happening and hard to tell exactly what the effects are. I mean, you know, obviously not a giant effect on economic growth.
And we should point out that you did work in the later years in the Bush White House, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors.
And did you argue in favor or against the tax cuts that were going on?
So I wasn't there in 2001 and 2003. Did play a role in helping think about and design the 2008 tax cut.
So given what you're saying, why do Republicans continually want to cut taxes, cut taxes, cut taxes, and say that that's what's going to make the economy grow? It sounds like it's not that simple at all and maybe just totally wrong.
So it's not that simple. So not all tax cuts are created equal, I think, is the most important thing to take away. And if you want to promote economic growth, what you want to do is have tax reform changes that encourage people to work more, to save more, to invest more. But at the same time, you find a way to pay for it so that you're not driving up deficits and crowding out investment. The other thing I'd say is we've gone through this long history where if you go back to the John F. Kennedy period and to the early Reagan years, we used to be in a situation where tax rates were at the top end were 50, 60, 70% if you go back to the Kennedy years. And there's a much stronger case to be made there that you can get a significant effect by lowering rates. Whereas today we're in a world where the top rates have been 35 to 40%, and you might be able to get some benefit from reducing those, but it's likely to be much smaller.
What are the economic effects of raising taxes as Bill Clinton did?
So it's pretty much everything in reverse, that you run the risk that you may discourage some economic activity, but if you're doing it in a way that reduces deficits, reduces the crowding out of private investment, it's something that can be beneficial for the economy in the long run. Again, depends exactly how you do it. There are better tax increases and worse tax increases.
So what would your advice be to policymakers in Washington right now as we look forward to the Trump administration?
The top level advice is that not all tax changes are created equal, not all tax cuts are created equal, and you should think carefully about what it is you're trying to accomplish. There's clearly an opportunity to improve the way we tax businesses. America is an outlier relative to the rest of the world. Tax rates have come down elsewhere. We're not the most attractive place to invest. You want to think about a way of designing the tax system so investment inside the United States, which creates better-paying U.S. jobs, is not discouraged by our tax system. And then you also ought to think about the concerns about deficit, and that if you want to do significant tax changes, you should think about ways to pay for it, perhaps by rolling back other tax provisions that really aren't that beneficial.
That's Donald Marin, who is Director of Economic Policy Initiatives at the Urban Institute. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, it was a pleasure. Thanks.
So what do you think? Do tax cuts work? And are you hoping for more under President-elect Trump? Let us know at hereandnow.org. The battle to retake Mosul, Iraq from ISIS has been going on for more than 2 months, and a spokesperson said today that several thousand Iraqi federal police are ready to join the fight. Iraqi forces and Kurdish forces are doing most of the fighting with the help of U.S. advisors and U.S. airstrikes. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter visited a base near Mosul yesterday.
Having isolated the city, the Iraqis, with our help, are now taking back neighborhoods in eastern Mosul and moving west.
Joining us now is NPR's Jane Arraf. She's in Sulaymaniyah, Iraq. And Jane, how is the offensive going at this point?
Well, Jeremy, it's kind of running into those hard, cold, grim realities of urban warfare in a really complicated setting. So Iraqi forces, and there are 100,000 of them, which is a huge number, backed, of course, by the coalition, primarily the United States, really made pretty good progress getting to the outskirts of Mosul, and then they made good progress kind of taking the neighborhoods on the outside. But now that they're getting deeper into the city, they're finding it harder and harder. So the way that American commanders put it, a commander that I spoke to here this week, said, imagine that this is an area twice the size of Washington, D.C., so it's toughest, of course, for the Iraqi forces. And one of the people that I've spoken with is a special forces commander on the Iraqi side. When I last saw him, it was in Fallujah in the summer, and Iraqi special forces had played the lead in taking back Fallujah. And he said, I think Mosul is going to be easier. So I went to see him just back from the front just a few days ago. And he said, well, you know, it was easier in a sense because we have so many more troops. But he talked about the difficulties of trying to get further into the city with ISIS using the tactics that it's using and so many civilians in there.
And what's happening to the civilians in Mosul amid all of this?
They're having a really tough time. Now, we have to remember this is Iraq's third biggest city. It had almost 1 million people in it. And now, by most accounts, it's got 700,000 to 800,000 still inside. So as Iraqi forces have been able to retake neighborhoods on the east side of the river, people have managed to escape. But those who have not managed to escape, still in neighborhoods held by ISIL, are being essentially herded further into the city so that they serve as protection for the ISIS fighters. We talk to people in Mosul by phone, and they tell us as well that for the past 10 days there's been no running water, so they're forced to take jerry cans to other neighborhoods in the cities on foot because gasoline is very scarce as well to try to get water. Some people are digging wells. Food is getting very, very expensive, but the main thing, of course, is really the terror of being caught between ISIS and the airstrike supporting Iraqi forces and the battle itself, which keeps pushing further and further into the city. It's still not across the river yet. Mosul is cut in half by a river. So all the fighting now has been on the east side, and there are a lot of civilians still on the west side.
And we've talked about the fact that Mosul is the biggest city that ISIS controls. Is there any way to gauge ISIS losses at this point in this battle?
Well, the United States has said recently that it believes that 50,000 ISIS fighters have been killed. That's really a tricky number because the U.S., here in Iraq in any case, relies almost completely on Iraqi information. So when they launch the airstrikes, and those are done in coordination with the Iraqis, they do it acting on intel that they have. It's mostly U.S. intel on who the targets are. They hit the targets, but then to get confirmation of who they've actually hit, that has to go back through the Iraqi chain, and it is very, very difficult to get an accurate picture. What we do know, Jeremy, is that there are inevitably civilians who are being killed in this. And some of the other people who are being killed can be classified as ISIS fighters, but we've been talking to families who have just come out of Mosul, some of them who had sons join ISIS. And they're talking about boys as young as 10 years old who were essentially brainwashed into joining. And certainly young teenagers are among the casualties there.
Jane, we know that the fighting is mostly being done by Iraqi troops and Kurdish fighters, but there is a U.S. advisory role. I know that you've been meeting with some American troops who've been deployed to Iraq. How are they doing at this point, and what role are they playing?
So the soldiers that I saw were actually, understandably, kind of bored. They're on bases. There's not a whole lot to do on some of those bases, but they're playing an essential role of basically a lot of them protecting U.S. forces who are further along and actually right with the Iraqi forces advising them. So it's bottom line is it's a very different war than any war the U.S. has been engaged in Iraq since 2003. And it's quite hands off, actually.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf joining us from Sulaymaniyah in Iraq, not far from the city of Mosul. Jane, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.